Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Lauren DeYoung-Schulman.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And we are all in the same place today, which is awesome. And we're also drinking an excellent bottle of Veuve, which Radha bought for me some time ago. And we're now drinking all together.
It came with its own Veuve koozie.
It really did, and I kept it, I'll be honest, but I should have used it today. It didn't even occur to me. I just wrapped it in a towel and put it in my bag and got on the metro.
Who needs a Veuve koozie for that long? Like, don't you just drink it?
Everyone needs a Veuve koozie.
But don't you just, that's, you know, I'm gonna
replacement leave it alone. Bottles, backup bottles, there are a lot of uses.
But why are we drinking today, Erin?
Well, I mean, why not just drink Veuve every day? But tomorrow when this airs will be my birthday.
Yay!
So we're all celebrating in the real spirit of the day by
Erin is a Capricorn.
I really am. We have an excellent guest with us here today.
We have the wonderful Dana Struhl with us here today, who is a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, newly from the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and also former colleague of Radha and I in the Office of the Secretary of Defense and the Office of Policy. So, Dana, welcome. We're so happy to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
We have, and this is very exciting for us all, a brand new set of Bombshell questions. The first of which is, what do you follow like a sport that is not a sport?
So I have to admit, I only acknowledged this to a select few colleagues before today. So now the secret is going to be out. I, at least once a day for my mental health break from the national security news, which is ever depressing, check entertainment news. And I have noticed over the past year that my entertainment news is focusing very much on royalty news.
Oh, so you follow the royals like sports. Royals.
Just like
which
sports.
Is also a sports team.
Exactly.
Is there really a fight between Kate and Meghan, or is this all fake?
My view is it's total fake news, and these are just two women living what can be a very stressful life, trapped in a bubble where you don't have a lot of freedom, and the press want to create a story where there is not one. And why wouldn't Prince Harry and Meghan Markle want to have their own residence just a little further out? They're starting this new life, they're about to have a new baby, and I think it's totally unfair.
Noted.
What show or series would you pitch to Netflix if you got the chance?
So this one I've had on the brain for about a decade since I worked with you all at OSD Policy.
Oh,
so Netflix,
I just can't wait.
If you pick this up, I would like just a little credit for my intellectual property. When I started out at the Pentagon, I worked on Iraq, and this was in 2008. And one of the issues that I focused on specifically was the ongoing disputes between the Iraqi Kurdistan region and the Baghdad-based government. And one of the things I learned is that then Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, with then President of the Iraqi Kurdistan region, Masoud Barzani, actually fought together in the days when Saddam Hussein was in power. Maliki went up into Kurdistan, hid out in the mountainous regions of Kurdistan with Masoud Barzani. The Kurds took him in, and together they fought, they bled, etc. And then, House of Cards style, Maliki comes into power in Baghdad. Masoud Barzani actually receives some U.S. assistance, is in a position of governance and responsibility in the Kurdistan region as they attempt to undertake serious economic reforms and provide for their own people. And these two guys cannot figure it out. The things that they've said to each other, the things that they've threatened publicly in Iraq, are perhaps even worse than what we're experiencing today in Washington and across the United States, the very visceral debates in Iraq. So I think this would be an amazing multi-part series of these two men growing up together, surviving in very austere conditions during the days of Saddam Hussein, all the way to today and what happens in the politics in Baghdad and Erbil.
Now I just want like Dairy Girls, but set in Kurdistan.
Wow.
Like in Erbil.
I was thinking it was more House of Cards meets Iraqi politics.
Yeah, I was wondering if this was like House of Cards.
Yeah.
You can, Homeland.
You can have that, but I want Dairy Girls. If you guys haven't watched that, we'll get to it in pop culture because it's by far the best thing that we've seen in a while.
I'm picturing this feels very Israeli to me for some reason. Just sort of like the brother with brother, then brother against brother, and then, yes, it'll be great. Radha, you know what? This is a data and statistics question that we switched over. It is now Erin's question.
What is your favorite algorithm? So that could be like I'm sort of fascinated by the Spotify Discover Weekly algorithm, or even in a much more basic way, how elevators work. So what is your favorite algorithm?
So because this is a podcast and you can't see me, you wouldn't know that I'm 7.5 months pregnant. And this is baby number two, which means I'm super behind on getting ready at all for baby number two. And I realized I could turn to Pinterest and check out different ideas for a nursery that were not too gender specific. And in the middle of Pinterest sending me a lot of ideas for a nursery, I keep getting a ton of different posts on how to lose the baby weight really quickly. And I'm thinking, what is it about Pinterest that they know that that's what I'm interested in and none of those checklists for first-time moms, what to remember at the hospital or how to get your baby to latch or any of these other issues? No, Pinterest is solely focused on helping me figure out what to put in a nursery and then how to lose the baby weight. And so what is it about that algorithm that knows the things that I'm going to obsess about?
The Pinterest algorithm. That's a good one. That's one to puzzle through. I like it. Okay.
So we usually select our guests on Bombshell based on either a topic that we know nothing about or very little about, or based on something that's going on in the news that we just say WTF and just have like blank, terrified looks on our faces. So as it happens, there's kind of a combination of, well, lots of them, but like at least two specific ones that are going on that we wanted to ask Dana about. The first of which is, what is going on in U.S. Syria policy right now? And, we should note, this is Monday, the 14th.
It could be different by the time this airs.
It absolutely could. But as of today, I feel like as to preserve this moment in time, what is going on in U.S. Syria policy right now?
Well, at this moment, I would say it did change in the last 12 hours based on the most recent presidential tweet. But just let's focus on the past month. In December, there were a lot of threats from the government of Turkey about an imminent invasion into northern Syria. And of course, northern Syria and eastern Syria is where our U.S. forces have been partnering with local Kurdish Syrian forces, otherwise called the YPG, who are the ground force that fight ISIS, while U.S. forces provide advice and technical assistance and training and weapons and then air support from the sky. What happened in late December is President Trump had a phone conversation with the president of Turkey, Erdogan, and decided that all U.S. forces were going to pull out of Syria. Erdogan said, "Mr. President, why do you have forces? You said your forces are there to defeat ISIS, and ISIS is defeated, so they should get out." And
that's kind of where we last left the story. We did our emergency podcast on Mattis's departure, and it was teed up by this conversation on the phone.
There you go. So President Trump says, you know what? You're right. You can finish whatever's left. Our forces will pull out. We've defeated ISIS. And since that time, National Security Advisor Bolton has undertaken a trip to Turkey and Israel, which did not go so well. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has embarked on an 8-country tour, of which he's finishing up, I believe, today or tomorrow, visiting so many countries in the Middle East to also talk about what U.S. goals and objectives are for Syria and make the case that the United States is not leaving and we are not abandoning the fight against ISIS. And he has a really tough job because every day what the president says and the conditions for U.S. withdrawal change. So to go back to prior to December, the U.S. had said we have three objectives for what we're doing in Syria. One is to defeat ISIS. The second one is to counter the Iranian presence in Syria. And the third one is to get a political process in place under United Nations conditions of a previous Security Council resolution for some sort of political process that would end the underlying conditions of the civil conflict, the civil war in Syria. What changed is then Bolton in Israel said, well, the conditions for U.S. withdrawal are, one, the defeat of ISIS, which begs the question, if he's saying that the conditions for the withdrawal of U.S. forces is defeating ISIS, then what was happening with the president in his phone conversation with Erdogan in December?
Bolton was privy to, right? Like, he's in the room and is not able to answer the question, which I still think is not getting enough coverage that he was not able to defend his own position here. But proceed.
I agree. And for all of us who have had experience in the national security decision-making process, this would open up a whole different set of questions about organizational functionality.
Who was staffing him?
Exactly. And a sound national security decision-making process based on various layers of decisions and risks and pros and cons. But anyway, we'll set that aside for now. The new condition that Bolton laid out is assurances from Turkey that when U.S. forces withdraw, Turkish military would not come into north and eastern Syria and slaughter the local partners of the U.S. forces, which is the Syrian Kurds.
So basically the condition is no genocide? Minimal genocide. Limited genocide.
So we understand, and of course...
Squishy genocide. Light genocide.
Something like that, yes.
Check.
And of course, what's missing there are the other two conditions, right? The one that, as we understand, for Bolton has always been the big one, which is countering Iran. And he's seen Syria as the linchpin of this beyond the Iran nuclear issue. How do you push back on Iran in the region? Syria. Syria is where you get a land bridge of Shia militias and Iranian-backed proxy forces coming from Tehran to Baghdad, to Damascus, to Beirut, threatening Israel, which is, of course, the worst-case scenario and what we're trying to prevent.
I mean, you could have, like, an international coalition and a lot of sanctions designed to, like, hem in the Iran nuclear program and, like, have everyone agreed to, like, keep that from happening.
But they're going to lie, because everyone lies, and land bridge.
Okay, okay. We digress.
Land bridge of Shia.
Land bridge of Shia. And of course, here's the thing. The administration had always made this rather tenuous argument that even though U.S. forces were in Syria under the 2001 authorization for the use of military force, which means 9/11 Al-Qaeda, and that is...
And its adherents and affiliates.
Correct. That's right. ISIS, an affiliate of Al-Qaeda. So that's our legal justification for deploying forces in Syria. The extra benefit of U.S. forces being in Syria is that we can prevent that land bridge, which means that we have a check on an expansion of Iranian influence in Syria, which, of course, is the primary objective of U.S. foreign policy in the region. If you listen to President Trump during his campaign, and if you listen to what we know John Bolton and Mike Pompeo consistently say, both as cabinet-level officials and before in their previous positions.
All right, so fast forward. We're now at January 14th, bordering on the 15th. A great day, by the way. What in the world is our Syria policy today?
So that's the thing I can't really tell you, because it changes every day. If you listen to Mike Pompeo in the Sunday talk shows over the weekend, he said the policy hasn't changed. There's plenty of ways for us to continue knocking ISIS and getting at our core Iran goal without U.S. forces present in Syria. And he specifically said, I believe, on Face the Nation on Sunday, until every Iranian boot is out of Syria. This brings us back to the question, Aaron, you asked earlier, which is exactly what is the policy and strategy for countering Iran? And what's left a lot of people scratching their heads, and actually, interestingly, has been very unifying of the right and the left foreign policy establishment in D.C. is, other than sanctions, exactly what is the policy? What is the strategy?
And just for folks who don't follow the president's Twitter feed in real time as the rest of us, this morning the president tweeted about sort of ending the last few strongholds with sort of bases outside of Syria, and then crushing the Turkish economy should they violate the terms and harm the Kurds. So can you walk us through that as the feasibility of that as our Syria policy?
So I've been watching the Twitter reaction to the president's new tweet, and there are a lot of people that are trying to figure it out. He said a couple really eyebrow-raising things in that tweet. The first one, or actually the final part of the tweet that is getting a lot of attention, is this notion, he said, of a 20-mile buffer zone. So in theory, that's actually exactly what the Turkish government has been asking for from the United States for a long time. The idea of that buffer zone is that there's distance between where the Syrian Kurds are setting up their semi-autonomous areas in Syria, which means that they are insulated from Turkey's restive Turkish Kurdish population. And number two, probably, is where the Turks would like to send some of the Assyrian refugees that they are hosting in Syria back into Syria. And of course, this opens up a whole other set of questions about dignified and safe return. What are these people going to do? Then, of course, there's all the policy questions, like who would protect this 20-mile buffer zone? Who are the forces that are...
You and what army?
Well, probably according to Erdogan and his op-ed in the New York Times a few weeks ago, the Turkish military would oversee this buffer zone. So that's a problem. And then, of course, you actually have President Trump stating what many people here are concerned about, which is that U.S. forces and the U.S. government gave our assurances to the Syrian Kurds that if you partner with us and you bleed for us and you die in this mission to counter ISIS, we will protect you. And what we did, what happened in December with that sort of out of the blue phone conversation and then new policy, is there was no time to plan and no time to put in place what could be a reasonable plan for the protection of these people and the communities that they're trying to establish. So now you have President Trump saying, yep, we want those assurances from Turkey that you're not going to slaughter the Kurds. And if you do, we'll devastate you economically, which again opens up a whole new set of policy questions about what that means.
So yeah, we were just chatting about this before the podcast, and you know, a like sort of longstanding issue is about U.S. economic ties with Turkey, which we can talk about another time. But it seems like on a pure sort of traditional trade tariff model, we probably wouldn't have the economic ties to crush the Turkish economy with
Sounds
just
really
trade.
Good, though.
But I think if we had a sanctions regime against Turkey, which we could sustain and then impose secondary sanctions on so that anyone else who wanted to trade with Turkey, that could bite. But it's not clear to me under what authority that sort of type of sanction regime could be put in place. So just sort of backing up a step here, and maybe as a sort of wrap up point, sort of in the region, sort of where what are our sort of big leverage or pressure points to get us to a state of the world where we can contain or reduce ISIS, prevent a Kurdish genocide, and not start a war with our NATO ally Turkey?
So those are all really good questions. And at this point, I would say it seems that the tools of leverage that the United States has available to it, in general, the Trump administration is taking tools off the table. So if the idea is providing communities liberated from ISIS in Syria an alternative to turning to ISIS 2.0 or turning to Iran, you would want to provide them with some baseline assistance so they can recover, clear out the mines, set up some resilient governance infrastructure, et cetera, except the Trump administration cut off all of the stabilization assistance. If the idea is to provide some assurances to these communities that the Turkish military or the Assad regime or Russian mercenaries or IRGC and Iranian Shia militias are not going to attack you, 2,000 U.S. forces is a rather small investment to provide some assurances to those communities, but now we're taking that off the table. In terms of economic leverage, we're at a point, I think, where the United States is going to have to make some decisions about, are we going to over-sanction the entire world to death every time they disagree with the policy position?
And especially given, I mean, we're having hard enough time, I think, trying to sustain the secondary sanctions on Iran, right? So trying to do secondary sanctions on Turkey, on a NATO ally, seems maybe, that seems like an uphill climb at a minimum.
I agree with you. And at the same time, there's been much debate here about cutting off Turkey from the F-35 program. What if Turkey buys the S-400 missile defense system from Russia? What does that mean for our NATO alliance? And look, broadly speaking, Congress has passed a series of aggressive sanctions against Russia. The Trump administration has gotten us into a trade war with China. We seem to be picking a fight with the EU. We're attempting to reconstitute the entire Iran sanctions regime, and underscoring how difficult it is to do it at this point in time, the Trump administration had to issue waivers for many of those sanctions to many of the biggest countries who have economic ties with Iran, like China and Turkey and Iraq, etc. So what does this mean for actually imposing economic pain on Turkey for this? I think it will be tough.
So the other WTF issue that we brought Dana on to discuss, and she just so recently came from the Hill, is, I guess I'll put it this way, one of few unifying issues that we have in the DC establishment these days is people looking at Trump and saying, in terms of your foreign policy, particularly your Syria policy, you're doing it wrong. But Congress really hasn't done much more than have some really, really great tweets, I'd say, about it, and not done a whole lot other things to change, incentivize, provide oversight to motivate Trump's actions on this. We have a new House coming in. Well, I guess we have new Senate and House, but in particular, we have Democrats leading in the House. How might we expect Congress to react to Trump's more kind of insane contradictory policies like this in the Middle East differently this time around?
That's a really good question. So my first response to that is I'm pretty skeptical about really hard-hitting legislation coming out of Congress at this point in time. And the reason is because you have a Democratic-controlled House and you have a Republican-controlled Senate, and the margin between the majority and the minority in the Senate actually increased from this Congress compared to the last Congress. I think that we're going to see a lot of hearings, a lot of attempts at oversight work. Looking at Mike Pompeo's trip around the region, what he is clearly attempting to do is reassure governments and align the United States with the governments of the region. And what has been consistently missing from the past week is attempts to speak to the people of the region, raise critical issues like insane human rights abuses happening prolifically across the region, issues like Washington Post journalist Kamal Khashoggi and what happened with him at his murder in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, etc. These are issues that have actually been quite unifying on the right and the left, bicamerally and bipartisan. Another one is the conflict in Yemen. But you can see, even with the conflict in Yemen, at the end of the last Congress, when you had a Republican-controlled House and a Republican-controlled Senate, and Democrats and Republicans were working together on legislation, actual meaningful legislation that would put limits on the executive's exercise of foreign policy was incredibly difficult. So is it going to happen this year as we get ready for 2020? I'm skeptical.
Well, that was very uplifting. And I'm glad I have, I have a half bottle left of champagne to continue drinking. But I think, I mean, these are all issues that tie together. And Dana, I think you highlight a very interesting dance that could happen on the Hill. Whereas before, like, maybe Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell would allow something to come through that criticized the Yemen war because it was bipartisan and they could kind of control it. But it's really hard to imagine Mitch McConnell working with Nancy Pelosi and giving Hill Democrats a win, especially with so many Senate Democrats potentially running for office in 2020, running for president in 2020. So that creates a sort of a different dynamic about who wants to generate wins and what level of dissent they're willing to tolerate on foreign policy issues vis-a-vis the White House.
I absolutely agree. And I think what we've seen from Mitch McConnell is when the pressure becomes overwhelming, especially when there's such concern coming out of the media environment, the advocacy community, et cetera, he will allow certain votes to come to the Senate floor, but in contained situations. And now in the House, if you look at some of the dynamics in the House, all of the Democratic-controlled committees are ramping up on their oversight and investigation staff. Transparency, accountability, these things are going to be really important. I think the American public needs to hear about these investigations and understand exactly how the Trump administration has arrived at certain policies. The problem is, with a Republican-controlled Senate, they're going to look at all these efforts in the House and say, this isn't about what's in America's interest, it's what's in the Democratic Party's interest.
Well, it's hard to imagine grandstanding in a House of Representatives hearing. I mean, what I would have never. Well, thank you very much for joining us, enlightening us on these very complex issues, helping us get reset after several weeks off from the podcast. An excellent start to the new year and excellent answers to the new bombshell questions. Thanks, Dana.
Great to be with you all.
Okay, let's keep up some foreign relations.
Half a bottle of champagne in.
Look, it's fine. Did anybody listen to this speech from Mike Pompeo this week?
I didn't listen to it. Like, who listens to speeches anymore these days? I just like watch the live tweet of it, and that seems to be plenty. But I have learned that America has a reinvigorated role in the Middle East.
And that Barack Obama ruined everything.
More or less, and also that Iran is bad. That appears to be more or less what we should take away from this.
Do we know who's worse? Kind of a toss-up, I think, according to the speech.
I think we're not going to hug it out with Ayatollahs. That's my takeaway.
Okay.
No more hugging it out.
The best part about the whole thing is the line that, you know, I assume was probably written weeks ago and they were just really excited about, which is, when America retreats, chaos follows. Awkwardly.
Right, yeah, awkward.
Our planned Syria withdrawal.
Yeah, it's an odd, I mean, so obviously there are these symmetries. You know, Pompeo, as Dana said, is on this sort of rainbow tour of the region and had a stop in Cairo. And so there's this parallel with Obama's Cairo speech from, you know, more basically a decade ago.
10 years ago, yeah.
And they're very, very different bookends. But, you know, so in the one way, you know, President Obama is trying to reset the relationship with the region. And I think a lot of folks would argue, well, that was an interesting vision. He was ultimately not successful in accomplishing that end. The Arab Spring starts, you know, a few years later, and ISIS then reemerges, and there's just a very different set of dynamics. It's almost like Pompeo wants to just be like, so it's like 2002 and we're all good here, right?
Totally.
It was a very weird Back to the Future sort of vision for the American role in the Middle East that took into account neither the previous 10 years nor the previous 10 days worth of engagements on U.S. Middle East policy. That's a weird place to be.
I also have some follow-up questions on... On the Mattis situation. So,
yes.
Remember how he quit because we were withdrawing from Syria, and also because we hate alliances now and he likes alliances?
So far as I recall, yes.
But now we don't like Iran and we're not withdrawing from Syria. Isn't that like totally his jam?
I think we're still totally withdrawing from Syria, just on like not the president's Twitter timeline.
I see.
And although, again, like, ask me again tomorrow. So I think the withdrawal is happening. I also think that part of what Mattis was objecting to was the process by which the withdrawal was announced.
We're going to send him a process as my Valentine mug.
We definitely should.
Fab.
But it's, I mean, this remains a sort of, despite this being something that the president, as we talked about a month ago, has been interested in for several years, even a month later, we're honestly no closer, it seems, to an actual plan for orderly drawdown and sort of protection. Both because the Department of Defense seems to be kind of on the sidelines, and the president and John Bolton are totally at odds, but like not acknowledging that. It's a very odd situation between a president and a national security advisor, my mind.
Like, do they see each other every day? I assume not. I also just like, conceptually, for Pompeo to say, we're going to have a more robust role in the Middle East. So we are pulling out of Syria. We are not really getting involved in the whole like, Gulf States quagmire that is going on and has been going on for a long time. We are in theory going to be announcing a Middle East peace plan, but it's been delayed yet again, thank God, because I'm going to Israel in a week. And I don't really see it.
And the president completely disrespected the Iraqis when he went to U.S. military base there, but didn't go to Baghdad to meet the political leadership.
Yeah.
And the Turks are clearly, there's a whole situation with the Turks at this point. So it's a bang up time for everyone.
Yeah, well, and just to sort of help us talk about the next foreign relation that we're not keeping up, I think this is indicative of this broader problem that we've talked about before, which is tweeting and giving speeches about sort of conceptual engagements and the substantive processes our Valentine work that like sort of undergirds that and makes it a reality are generally need to be at least in some way integrated. And so policy by speech making was a critique of the Obama administration.
I know. It feels so precious now that I'm really worried about that.
Ex post process that sort of rationalized that speech. And now we've seen sort of the pinnacle version of this, which is policy by speech making with multiple different principals making different speeches. And so, you know, question mark, exclamation point.
Well, I think that this is also, and we will almost certainly come back to this over the next weeks and months. One is that the president has a certain set of advisors, and he's cycled through them over time, who clearly had different policy preferences than him. And so whether that was Secretary Mattis or H.R. McMaster or others, you just knew they were on a different page and they were trying to corral the president. Now we have John Bolton, who is on the same page as the president in certain things, like with regard to arms control or sort of holding his breath on North Korea, which we'll get to here in a second, but clearly isn't out in left field with regard to the president's Middle East policy. And so you're in this situation where no matter how many process Valentines you send, nobody speaks for the president because the president actually doesn't really have stable policy preferences. And so I don't even know what kind of process you're supposed to run to like implement what the man wants to
do. And the flip side is there is no process that can implement a changing principles, external announcements of policy.
I don't know. I think he does have some stable policy preferences. He's long wanted to pull out of Syria and he doesn't really like wars where we're spending a whole lot of money and he's not seeing results. He doesn't like it when generals then make fun of him for that or when pseudo dictators like Erdogan say like WTF, that doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. He feels as though his pride is being shamed by that.
So on that front, we are at this point sort of expecting a second summit with North Korea, which again really gets to this kind of foreign policy as performance bit that we were discussing a second ago. There's been some movement amongst the other players involved in North Korea. So both the North Koreans and South Koreans have had some continued meetings. Kim Jong-un was just in China this last week. Again, kind of, I don't want to call it an opening of North Korea, but certainly a thawing of relations between those two particular actors. But the U.S. side, as far as I understand, has gotten almost nowhere. And so we had a lot of theater last summer with the Singapore summit. There's been no formal documentation of the obligations that come out of that. There's been no real disarmament, certainly on the North Korea side. There was a freeze in war games by the U.S., although I think we're planning on going forward with them this year. But we're going to tee up a second summit between the two presidents, between the two heads of state. Like, that just strikes me as like a very weird way of like keeping the ceremony going without doing, you know, as we've been talking about in other places, the hard actual work of diplomacy, of agreement negotiation, and of corralling disputing elements of your own government to get on the same page with a complex policy.
Yeah, I mean, it seemed like a long, long time ago, but late last year, Kim Jong-un made a statement effectively saying that they were no longer taking steps to make weapons or to make nuclear weapons. He said it's a little more artfully than that, but not a whole lot. That is, of course, against all evidence to the contrary. There's no evidence that that is actually true. There's lots of evidence that is false in like any number of possible ways. However, the President Trump kind of eats those sorts of statements up. And now, in the absence of Mattis, who, while he himself did not play a big role in the overall negotiation with North Korea, I always sensed was a maybe providing some rational and logical thought to the overall process of like, no, let's not pull all of our forces out of South Korea. Let's not substantially change our nuclear posture in the region. He is not there anymore. And I do wonder in his absence and with Bolton there, how much is that going to mean that we're going to have a more kind of radical, crazy, just say whatever the hell you want without any real impact kind of Korea policy over the next 6 months?
Say, what more, anyone? What, like, you remember the fire and fury tweets?
Okay. Well, we are seeing this on Iran. There's been reports out both the New York Times and Wall Street Journal this week talking about basically Bolton being like, so what you got for Iran options? And, you know, Mattis tried to slow roll that. It'll be very interesting to see if Patrick Shanahan has any instinct or ability to slow roll craziness out of the White House, or if he's just like, well, I don't know. Let me ask General McKenzie down at CENTCOM. We'll get those right up for you. So that's going to be an interesting set of dynamics. You know, on the Iran front. And I mean, John Bolton is waiting for diplomacy to fail in North Korea so he can do what he wants to do to North Korea. And that's not a great situation.
And I think that's right. And I think in particular, you know, we have this problem, which we've talked about before, and maybe this can transition us a little bit to the trade discussion, which is China is a key player in the region. And we're like in a like pretty big fight with them, like a super awesome trade war. And so we have sort of tied in these timelines is also this March deadline on figuring out a new agreement with China regarding trade, where basically the Trump administration agreed to delay the doubling, or actually going from 10% to 25% tariffs on a bunch of Chinese goods in exchange for trying to work out this deal until March 1st. And then if in March, if this doesn't happen, then, you know, the tariffs jump up. So we have this weird sort of China dynamic happening in parallel to this North Korea dynamic in a world in which we probably could use China as a sort of ally or a partner, let's call it more light than an ally, in dealing with North Korea. It's just worth noting the Wall Street Journal actually has an interesting article about China having a record surplus with the U.S. in 2018. So 17% increase in the trade deficit, which is notable for the fact that, for those who don't remember, that tariffs are just taxes on trade, that if demand is inelastic, that is, if people aren't responding to higher prices, then all that's really happening is we're making American consumers pay more, or American producers needing intermediate goods pay more for Chinese goods, which appears to at least be what happened in 2018. And so that's not great.
So speaking of brilliant economic policies, if we shift onward to trade, so it turns out Brexit is still a thing and it's still a total Charlie Foxtrot. And there's a huge vote scheduled for tomorrow in the House of Commons in Britain on Theresa May's Brexit plan, which basically no one likes, but they all like for different dislike for different reasons. And they're kind of on the verge of a constitutional crisis.
Yep.
Yep.
Okay, good. I'm glad we've got that sorted out. We will definitely talk more about Brexit, but we have our own constitutional crises brewing here in the United States.
I heard talk of this.
Few of them.
The government shutdown, if we're going to move on to White House mayhem, is not exactly a constitutional crisis, but the kind of political dynamics and the potential remedies to the shutdown start to get dicey a little bit fast. We're in week four. About a quarter of the government is currently shut down, 800,000 employees nationwide, about 100,000 people here in the D.C. region affected by furloughs. People are not getting paid. That is like the small number compared to both the contractors and the vendors and everybody else who actually depends on a pretty robust federal workforce in various locations. But we need a border wall, apparently. Are we going to get
one?
It's
not a wall, Erin.
Like,
we
could
call it a fence.
That's
or
right.
a barrier,
right.
or really anything you want. And it's going to be beautiful.
It's going to be a beautiful steel structure along the border, apparently. What's going on with this? Where is this discussion at the moment?
At the moment, it appears to be just like an ongoing game of chicken. As you said, we are in day 24. Agencies that are shut down include agriculture, transportation, interior, state, homeland security, the executive office of the president, so like the actual White House. And you mentioned how there's 800,000 workers impacted. Half of them, at least, if not more than that, are still actually working. So going to work on a day-to-day mm-hmm. basis, not actually being paid. Though increasingly, a lot of them are calling in sick or not showing up at all, as we're seeing at TSA. There's an estimate that this is costing us about $1.2 billion weekly in terms of economic cost to the nation, depending on how you add it all up. And it's starting to have more and more impacts on people's day-to-day lives, whether food stamps or ability for people to get certain kinds of federal mortgages or to launch IPOs or to go to national parks and things along that line. But yeah, I have zero faith that we're any closer unless the president uses a national emergency that we'll talk about in our next section.
Yeah. So apparently the president thinks, he's been told by his lawyers, that he can declare a national emergency, which is a thing that happens fairly often, to be honest.
We have 30 of them in effect today.
Right. But they don't usually tend to be used for totally going around the Congress and issuing new procurements.
Correct.
But he thinks that this would be a way. Well, initially it was floated, right? Yep. The initial idea was that we might be able to have a national emergency to get a wall and then we could reopen the government.
Right. And just to be clear, if you break that up into two parts, there's a national emergency that gives him the authority to basically divert funds.
Right.
And then there's the finding the appropriated funds that you would divert
you actually use
from,
yep.
that you would use, and directing a portion of the executive branch to execute the funding and sort of do whatever, right? So there's like, there's the authorities, the appropriation, and then the execution.
Right. So, the president has to decide this is the best way to do this. Interestingly, DOJ, who has not exactly stood up to the president on these matters a whole lot in the past, would also have to say, like, yep, this is cool. They're not always all that great on...
They're also under furlough.
They're also under furlough right now, though a large portion of the workforce is actually sure. working right now unpaid. And like, if you start to look through the number of special powers the president could have during a national emergency, which includes shutting down the internet or locking bank accounts, kind of gets a little terrifying after a while, but you do have to have DOJ approval.
So the accounts that the president, or at least executive branch, has identified as being ripe for raiding for border wall appropriations are within the Department of Defense, and it's the Army Corps of Engineers.
Right. Yeah.
So these are things that could be related to hurricane relief or building of new dams or reinforcing of existing structures. Army Corps of Engineers has all kinds of interesting things in the interior of America. But this is one of these things where this is just, to my mind, 100% not how this process is supposed to work. A set of negotiations that the president easily could have had with Republican-controlled House and Senate 2 months ago, but didn't. And now, but thought I think that he could get a better political outcome by blaming things on Nancy Pelosi. And so here we are.
Now, everyone should read Quinta Jurassic, as you always do. She has a piece this week about whether or not this is actually all that bad and abuse of the national emergency power. And she's like, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it really could be worse. Like there are authorities that are consistent with this. There are accounts that are consistent with this. It's effectively, yes, you could say that it is military construction in some way. It's not like Korematsu. Now, that doesn't mean that it's not a step towards that. And the president won't say that, wow, actually, this is a really great authority to use. And we could see him abuse this elsewhere. But in the grand scheme of things, of this narrow authority, And it also possibly gets us off the cliff in terms of the shutdown and reopens the government, which I'm in favor of.
Except that he's then come out and said, well, I could just build a wall and still not reopen the government. So he's saying the quiet part out loud again and removing any incentive for anyone to go along with this incredibly politically risky scheme for certain parts of the electorate.
I'd also just note that my understanding is the total funds identified are actually not enough to construct the wall over the section he wants to construct.
Nowhere.
So I just want to be really clear that we're not going to end up with a wall at the end of this. That may or may not be the point, or the we're not going to end up with a fence barrier or whatever structure.
We're
going like
to end up with
it.
Some sort of like Arrested Development Bluth wall that's like 3 feet wide and like $5 billion.
It's going to be beautiful with slats, I believe.
Right. So to cheer
maybe
us up,
Trex?
Pop culture.
There's kind of a lot, although like it's Oscar season.
That's right.
It's Golden Globe season. So there were some big, you know,
Julia Roberts looks great, guys.
I mean, that's kind of always true. I went to see Mary, Queen of Scots.
Oh.
I was disappointed. I mean, I love Saoirse Ronan. I love Margot Robbie, but this was not the
that's
movie that I liked. But The Favorite is extraordinary.
Okay.
Olivia Colman won Golden Globe for Best Actress. It is a riot. It is really very enjoyable. I think almost all Bombshell listeners will appreciate it. It is fairly depraved, I think is important to just sort of note. Not super family friendly, but...
Don't go with your dad.
Yeah, but it's totally awesome. You've got some TV that you're looking forward to this week.
My favorite book about witches, demons, and vampires is now coming to television in the United States. The Discovery Witches will be available on Sundance now. Everyone tune in on Thursday.
It has Matthew Good.
It does have Matthew Good. It's going to be so great.
Only hope that the TV show has more plot than the book.
Oh, I mean, who cares about plot?
If it's Matthew Good, we could just watch it on mute. Like it kind of doesn't matter.
Radha has pop culture.
I do. So you all should know and love The Saint with Val Kilmer. Turns out
it's like a 20-year-old movie.
Listen, I'm catching up, guys, slowly but surely. But it turns out there's a later movie with Elijah Dushku, who is also Faith on Buffy the Vampire Slayer. We could have a longer conversation about Buffy, which I love, and which I also watched. It's not very good, but also awesome. And then it turns out, after realizing that I liked this and became vaguely obsessed with The Saint, I started watching the 1950s and 60s series with Roger Moore, in which you can see Roger Moore come from a sort of playboy transition into the James Bond character he would later play. So it's a romping good time in black and white and then color, and I recommend it.
I love it when Radha has pop culture.
Makes me very happy.
That's all.
As we mentioned before, Derry Girls is a delight. It is on Netflix. It is about high school girls in Derry, Londonderry, Northern Ireland in the 1980s. If nothing else, it has an amazing soundtrack and it's highly, highly entertaining.
You might want to watch some of them with the closed caption on.
Closed captions are helpful in almost all settings, I'm just going to say.
All of us are deaf.
What are you going to do?
Yeah.
Well, we're going to finish this bottle of champagne and say goodbye to all you all. See you next week.